Major funding for NJ Spotlight News is provided in part by NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com, and by the PSCG Foundation.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, protests at Princeton. Two students are arrested after building a Gaza solidarity encampment with roughly 100 other supporters amid growing campus protests nationwide.
The atrocities that were committed on October 7th were horrific, and they do not change the fact that in the last 6 months, once again, over 34,000 Palestinian lives have been taken.
Plus, remembering Donald Payne Jr. Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman pays tribute to her late colleague and friend.
It's just hard for me to imagine that I'm not going to see that face. I'm not going to see that dapper Dan with his eyeglasses to match every suit that he had and every bow tie.
Also, protecting LGBTQ students. Advocates are calling on school districts to readopt a policy aimed at protecting transgender students.
Every student deserves a safe school to learn and grow in.
And pre-K fallout. Private child care centers are on edge, worried about losing children as the state expands universal pre-K programs. NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Vinozzi.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us this Thursday night. I'm Brianna Vinozzi. The nationwide campus protests over the war in Gaza have erupted at Princeton University, where police arrested two graduate students this morning, shortly after demonstrators set up an encampment at the Ivy League school, showing their solidarity with other pro-Palestinian movements and vowing to stay put until Princeton divests all funding from companies that are profiting off the Israel-Hamas war. Pop-up encampments and protests are now at close to 50 colleges and universities across the country, from Columbia in New York, where students have been protesting for more than a week, to the University of Texas and USC. All of it igniting a debate over not just the war, but American support for Israel and the right to free speech on college campuses. Ted Goldberg is in Princeton with the latest. Ted.
Brianna, some of the students here tell me they plan to remain at this encampment until Princeton fully divests from companies associating with Israel. They're joining similar student movements at campuses across the country. And the students here tell me this cause is so important to them, even if there are run-ins with law enforcement, they won't be scared away. Two graduate students were arrested this morning after pitching tents on McCosh Courtyard. Pitching tents is a school violation. The school says after repeated warnings from the Department of Public Safety to cease the activity and leave the area, two graduate students were arrested for trespassing. They have been immediately barred from campus pending a disciplinary process.
They will not be able to complete their degrees. Despite that, we have continued and built out a liberation zone that is now home to hundreds and hundreds of students who have reclaimed this portion of campus as their own in celebration of Palestinian life and the life that we will continue to give to Palestine once Princeton divests.
The intimidation on this campus goes on for weeks and weeks and months and months. The people who have been doxxed on this campus have been almost exclusively people of color. The two students, our comrades, were also people of color. Of all the students that they could have chosen, they have chosen two people of color. I think that's telling a lot about the climate here.
I think the university is acting in a heavy-handed manner in its treatment of its students, particularly the arrest of students, the eviction of students from housing, I think is not justified. I think it supersedes policy and procedure.
The combination protest and sit-in welcomes students leaving their classes, and speakers like journalist Chris Hedges. He was nearly arrested after using a megaphone to speak.
Let Chris stay! Let Chris stay!
Noise amplification, or using a speaker, is also against the rules at Princeton, so he was let off.
The reaction of the university is atrocious, it's overreaction. This is a peaceful, nonviolent protest.
Academic freedom here is under assault. There is a movement afoot to censor what faculty teach and what students learn. There are bureaucrats and theocrats in the United States government who would like to strip faculty members of tenure.
Professor Max Weiss joined over 100 pro-Palestinian students here to protest.
This genocide must stop. This genocide is a stain on the world.
At this point, it's a duty for all of us to stand up against genocide, against oppression, and for liberation. And this is the extension of the colonial imperial powers at play.
There were also counter-protesters by those supporting Israel. Folks held signs of hostages held by Hamas, and they say Princeton is in danger of becoming a hotbed of anti-Semitism.
Jewish students are under attack on campuses across America. Princeton is not the worst. I'm from New York. I see what's happening to Columbia.
Columbia recently canceled in-person classes after reports of anti-Semitic language at anti-Israel protests. Student Maximilian Meyer says the protesters' anti-Israel chants are also anti-Semitic.
Anti-Semitism is calling for the destruction of the state of Israel. The genocide of the Jewish people is anti-Semitism. So every student here who is Jewish is experiencing anti-Semitism, whether or not they feel that it's direct, because these people are calling for things that are anti-Semitic and that go towards the destruction of the Jewish people. That we cannot stand for.
We demand that Princeton University divest from companies profiting off of Israeli apartheid and a genocide campaign that has taken the lives of over 34,000 Palestinians, 70% of whom are women and children.
Emmanuel Sippi leads Princeton's Alliance of Jewish Progressives. And she doesn't agree that anti-Israel protests are anti-Jewish.
The atrocities that were committed on October 7th were horrific, and they do not change the fact that in the last 6 months, once again, over 34,000 Palestinian lives have been taken.
If Princeton doesn't divest, protesters don't plan to go away anytime soon, and counter-protesters plan to stay on Princeton's campus as well. At Princeton University, I'm Ted Goldberg. NJ Spotlight News.
State and federal leaders continue to mourn the death of Congressman Donald Payne Jr. The 65-year-old from Essex County died on Wednesday after suffering from a cardiac episode nearly 3 weeks ago that left him hospitalized and in a coma. The six-term Democrat from Newark represented New Jersey's 10th congressional district since 2013, succeeding his late father, who held the seat for nearly a quarter century. Payne's colleagues are remembering him as a dedicated public servant with a dapper sense of style, always wearing his signature bow tie and matching glasses. He was beloved by fellow members of Congress, including Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman, who worked alongside Payne for 10 years and in a statement yesterday said she loved him like a brother. She joins me now. Congresswoman, before we start, I just want to extend my condolences to you. I know you had such a dear relationship. Yesterday, you even wrote that he called you a sister mother. Were you close right off the bat? How did you come to have that type of relationship with Donald Payne?
Well, we were the two African-American members of the delegation, the state of New Jersey. Our fathers knew one another and worked very closely together. And that certainly was a beginning for us to jump off into a relationship. And we liked each other. We just immediately liked each other and trusted one another and recognized that we kind of shared the same legacy of service and expectation on our part. And so Donald and I just became, as he said, sister-mother relationship. Sister when we were working together and mother when I was bugging him about doing something for himself.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned about your life of public service. You both came from trailblazing fathers, families who really dedicated themselves to public service. And like his father, Donald Payne worked in his congressional seat up until his last moments. What do you feel will be his legacy?
A commitment to his constituents, working to further educate people on the impact of colorectal cancer, which his daddy succumbed to, worked on making sure that the Northeast Corridor Transportation Network was supported. Donald worked on policies that advanced equity and everything. And he loved his constituency so much that he probably did more one-minutes on the floor, recognizing the heroes in his community than any other member. And we used to tease him because on the floor, there's a seat that you put something in that seat to show that you're gonna do your 1 minute. And every time anybody would go by that seat, oh, Donald's got that seat already. He always wanted to make sure that he highlighted the good things and the good people of his district.
He played such a role both in the Black Congressional Caucus, but also as representing New Jersey, and how that leaves a hole now for the representation of his constituents, but of Black Americans in New Jersey.
Well, it's a big loss. It's a big loss to the state of New Jersey. It's a big loss to constituents who happen to be Black and to citizens who happen to be Black. But it is a big loss to constituency across the state of New Jersey. Donald obviously, you know, represented himself as a Black man, but the issues that he pursued were the betterment for all people. There was no animus in Donald. There was no bias. There was no prejudice. Donald wanted to do good work, and Donald did good work. And, you know, it is just hard for me to imagine that I'm not going to see that face. I'm not going to see that dapper Dan with his eyeglasses to match every suit that he had and every bow tie. I'm not going to see that smile. I'm not going to be able to, like, joke with my friend. This is heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking for all the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, but it's heartbreaking for the members of Congress that have had the blessing and opportunity to work with.
Yeah, for sure. He's been a pillar in New Jersey as well as in Congress. Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman, thank you for sharing those dear words about your friend.
Brianna, thank you. And I just want everyone to keep his family in prayer. I know where Donald's soul is. It is at rest, and he is not suffering. But I need his family to know that we love them and we hold them up in prayer.
With roughly 2 months left in the public school year, a pair of civil rights groups are making a final plea to 16 school districts, urging them to reconsider their stance on the state's gender rights policy, known as 5756. That sets guidelines for schools around parental notification of a student's gender identity. The letters from the ACLU and Garden State Equality were sent following the Roxbury School District's decision to join a growing list of systems scrapping the policy entirely, a move those advocates see as dangerous. Senior correspondent Brenda Flanagan reports.
Every student deserves a safe school to learn and grow in, and that's what this guidance is rooted in.
Gender rights advocates have watched in alarm as more than two dozen New Jersey school boards voted to revoke Policy 5756. The controversial state guidance advises trans and non-binary students should not be automatically outed to their families by school faculty or staff. It's a prime target of the conservative parental rights movement. But this week, both the ACLU and Garden State Equality sent letters to 16 districts urging them to readopt 5756.
It is clear communication that is focused on student safety. From a conservative standpoint, you could even say this would help reduce liability for a school district by having this policy, because then it's clearly laying out how we protect our students' safety.
And so we just want to make sure that all of these school districts understand that when they revoke these policies, it doesn't absolve them of their responsibilities.
The ACLU's Alila Huertas admits 5756 isn't mandatory, but notes school districts must follow New Jersey's tough law against discrimination. The letter says repealing 5756 leaves school administrators and staff without clear guidance, opening the district to liability. And it signals to LGBTQ+ students and families within your district that its schools may not be a safe and welcoming environment to all.
You know, as LGBTQ+ students are facing renewed threats across the country, New Jersey has a responsibility to lead by example here and ensure that students are safe and welcome in our schools.
Huertas wouldn't comment when asked whether the ACLU's been contacted by a family in one of the 16 districts that got a letter. They include Lacey Township's Board of Ed, represented by attorney Bruce Padula, who said, generally, the missive's not being well received.
I've heard from some people that I'm not going to mention that this is perceived as a bullying tactic of Garden State Equality and the ACLU and using legal and threatening language to scare school administrators. I believe, and I'm paraphrasing the letter to some extent, that it does say we'll be watching you.
Actually, the letter states our organizations will continue to monitor districts to ensure they're meeting their obligations to provide students with a safe environment that's free from discrimination. Padula's in court for two of three Monmouth County districts that have been sued by New Jersey's Attorney General after they adopted their own policies.
We have to reconcile the conflicting interests between parental rights, transgender student rights, and the rights and obligations of a school district to both parties.
Many believe districts are waiting for the court to offer direction. Meanwhile, at least three districts have abandoned efforts to rescind 5756. A recent poll showed more than half of New Jersey residents think the law should not require teachers to inform parents about their child's gender identity. I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
Meanwhile, free universal preschool has been a goal of both the Murphy administration and progressive groups in the state. The governor proposed an extra $20 million in the new state budget to expand free pre-K, adding nearly 1,000 more seats. But for private child care centers already facing funding challenges and staffing shortages, the timing couldn't be worse. As owners tell senior correspondent Joanna Gagas, the change could cause a drastic blow to their business.
Preschool expansion comes into a town and stays within the K-12 system, you are seeing those centers have to close. And that is what we're hearing from a lot of directors, is that there is a panic when expansion comes in or near their towns because they know the ripple effect.
Private child care centers depend on 3 and 4 year olds in their programs because those kids offset the much more expensive care of infants and toddlers that often leave centers at a net negative. So as the state expands its universal pre-K, many child care centers are wondering what role they'll have and if they'll survive.
We know the model works, and we need to tap back into that and see. It worked in those districts. It could work for preschool expansion as well.
Advocates for Children of New Jersey's Diane Delano says the state's already developed a successful partnership between its Abbott or SDA school districts and private child care centers in what's called a mixed delivery system, where students can attend pre-K in either public or private settings.
All of the districts did mixed delivery. They worked in partnership with their community-based agencies and child care programs, and it worked. I mean, they were able to keep their doors open. They were able to add highly qualified staff with BAs. They were able to, run high-quality community-based programs in collaboration with their school districts.
And as districts seek to develop programs with an infusion of $1.2 billion proposed in the education budget for pre-K expansion, DOE Commissioner Kevin Damer has said they should look to existing child care centers before launching any in-district programs.
There is a responsibility that we all have to make sure that all community has all the tenants it needs to be successful. And having a thriving infant and toddler before and after care and summer camp program is a big piece of society's being successful.
Right now, there is no mandate for districts to contract through existing child care centers, and not all centers want to be included in this model because it's still unclear for them how it all works and who's in charge.
It was difficult to follow the licensing guidelines and the DOE guidelines at the same time. They seem to clash.
Dawn Cleveland owns the Little Learners Child Development Center in Hackensack. She tried partnering with the Hackensack School District a few years ago, turning two rooms that were licensed for 23 kids into classrooms that could only hold 15 kids, according to DOE standards.
We would say, well, licensing says that we can't do that, and they would turn around and say, well, we're the DOE. So we need to do it our way.
The other challenge she faced was teacher compensation, where the district paid her pre-K teachers much higher than what she could pay her other employees.
They will entirely pay for the salary, but they are not entitled to the benefits of a district employee. Staff can only work for those 6 hours for those 180 days. A child care center is open, you know, 12 months a year, before care, after care, summer camp. So there's staffing implications there. And when that particular teacher works any of those hours, they're back down to that private pay salary.
I think that it's important that the small child care centers, like myself, should have the ability to give the families that are leaving me to go to public school to stay here. And maybe have like a voucher system or something where, as long as you have a teacher that has a BA and a P3 certification and you have a curriculum that's research-based, and why can't we keep those kids?
So would you want to contract directly with DOE, kind of bypass the individual district?
Oh, I would love that. That would be fantastic if we could do that. I think that would help us tremendously, especially now losing 9 children next year.
She's losing those kids to the Hackensack district that's rolling out its pre-K program in its existing buildings, leaving the future of her center uncertain. In Hackensack, I'm Joanna Gagas, NJ Spotlight News.
In our Spotlight on Business report, another victory for the labor movement. Two former cleaning staff members at the American Dream Mall are getting their jobs back and retro pay after a 3-judge panel at the National Labor Relations Board this week ruled in their favor, stating they shouldn't have been fired for meeting with union organizers. As Melissa Rose Cooper reports, advocates say the decision sends a clear message to anyone who violates workers' right to unionize.
The decision was good because I was unjustly terminated, and the judge decided in my favor now on the permanent basis.
Jose Terran, reacting to a recent ruling by a 3-judge panel of the National Labor Relations Board requiring American Dream contractor HSA Cleaning to reinstate him and his co-worker Louis Varela after they were both fired in 2022 for attempting to organize a union.
Well, they fired me and I was out of work for 13 months, and that affected me deeply because I depend on that job.
Last summer, both Terran and Varela returned to work after a federal judge ordered HSA to immediately reinstate them. Now, the NLRB's decision permanently secures their jobs, entitling them to receive any back pay in full.
Now that it's permanent, I feel safely, because before was in a temporary base and I was afraid that I may be terminated. So now I feel comfortable and safe.
So this happens quite often, unfortunately, with employers that are really opposed to unionization in their workplace. The labor law, you know, lacking those strong fangs and teeth of having some kind of, you know, financial penalty, will often just decide to engage in illegal activity like firing workers for organizing, because the cost is really low in the end. The ruling of reinstating these workers, I think, sends a strong message to their coworkers in the workplace that, yes, we are allowed to talk about having a union. And if we want to have a union, it's protected activity, so we can come together and discuss that and organize if we would like to do that.
A gratifying outcome for Kevin Brown, who serves as the executive vice president for 32 BJ Service Employees International Union.
This was the victory of an appeal of the administrative law judge's decision, which also reaffirms the federal court judge's decision. So we've won several rounds here for these workers in court, despite the company's best efforts to defeat us and defeat these workers' chances to win the American Dream at the American Dream Mall.
But despite the NLRB's ruling, Brown says many employees are still having a hard time on the job.
There's been harassment of these workers. These two workers and other workers, there's been terminations of other workers unlawfully because of exercising their rights to organize. We filed additional charges, which the Labor Board is investigating as well. Aside from violation of the workers' rights to organize, there's also been a lawsuit filed by the workers for sexual harassment, an independent lawsuit for two workers, and we actually believe there'll be more coming forward as well.
We reached out to HSA for comment and are awaiting a response. But lawyers for the company previously denied firing Terran and Varela out of retaliation for organizing a union and instead claimed they were let go due to necessary cuts in the workforce. The NLRB's ruling also requires information outlining employee unionization rights to be posted at the facility. American Dream is declining comment at this time. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Melissa Rose Cooper.
Turning to Wall Street, stocks took a nosedive today as the economy shows signs of slowing. Here's where the markets closed. And make sure to tune in to NJ Business Beat with Raven Santana this weekend. She focuses on New Jersey's construction industry, talking to the CEO of a woman-owned company about the challenges she faced in a male-dominated field and how it motivated her. Then, how more students are choosing a skilled trade over college, which could help fill a gap of 500,000 construction workers in the U.S. Watch it Saturday morning at 10 on the NJ Spotlight News YouTube channel. And that's going to do it for us tonight. But don't forget to download the NJ Spotlight News podcast so you can listen anytime. I'm Brianna Venozzi. For the entire NJ Spotlight News team, thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child. RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. And New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com.
Life is unpredictable. Health insurance shouldn't be. For over 90 years, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey has provided quality, affordable health plans to New Jersey residents. We have served generations of New Jersey families and businesses and are committed to driving innovations that put you at the heart of everything we do. Our members are our neighbors, our friends, and our families. We're here when you need us most. Horizon, proud to be New Jersey.